Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, Joanne, I'm going to dispense with tonight's intro because we have two great special guests tonight, and I don't want to waste any time. Our first guest is George Bunnell from the great band that I love, the Strawberry Alarm Clock. How are you, George?
Howdy.
Hi,
George. Welcome to the show, George. George, we appreciate you being here. We appreciate you making accommodations for us tonight. George is supposed to do the whole hour tonight, but we had to add somebody else in at 7:30. George is going to come back and do a full hour with us on another day. But in the meantime, George, the bassist for Strawberry Alarm Clock.
Yeah.
Incense and Peppermints. I got to ask, why, what the hell is Incense and Peppermints? What does it mean? I mean, where did it come from?
Yeah,
great song. I just, where did it come from?
Okay, so one day, it was one of those things where I never questioned it all these years.
Yeah.
And then John Carter, who wrote the lyrics, I went and visited him up in Cambria when he passed away a few years ago. But he was, before that, he was living up in Cambria, California. And I went and visited him and asked him, I said, by the way, what does incense and peppermints mean? And he goes, oh, it's real simple. He goes, because he had the title before he had the body of lyrics. And so the title, he said, all it was that the incense was to cover up the smell of pot. And then when you got the munchies, you had peppermints.
Got it.
You're kidding me.
Yeah, because
that's it.
Yeah, I couldn't think of what it was. And I said, well, I know it's definitely – now, you guys, were you into LSD and all that at the time when it was written, or was that later?
It was kind of – yeah, I guess we were a little bit into it, but we had definitely experimented, you know.
And influenced your music?
No. Most of the songs, like the songs that I wrote on that first album, on the Incense and Peppermints album, things like Rainy Day Mushroom Pillow, I wrote them with my best friend and next door neighbor, Steve Bartek, and we had no idea what we were writing about. We didn't do anything yet because we wrote them about a year or two before they were recorded.
Wow.
And so we really didn't. Yeah, we weren't thinking like that.
Well, it's funny because when I was doing some investigating on you, I noticed that the lead vocalist didn't even sing the track. And what happened to Greg Mumford, who came in and actually sang the vocal track?
He didn't want to be in the band. The band, well, you know, it was like they were trying everybody's voice out.
Right.
And the manager also managed Greg Mumford.
Right.
And he was sitting there, and they said, oh, well, Greg, you try it. And so he tried to sing it, and it came out right. And my theory is that it was in the wrong key for everybody else, and it was in the right key for Greg, because the song was already recorded as an instrumental.
Right.
And the producer had decided that he wanted to put He had John Carter, the lyricist, as in his publishing company, writing songs. John Carter had written another song called Acapulco Gold, which was also about pot. And so he said, you know, John Carter has this title called Incense and Peppermints that I think fits that music, and I'm going to have him write a set of lyrics to go with it. So Carter went and finished the lyrics and came back and had a melody and stuff and tried everybody's voice in the studio, and nobody's voice really seemed to fit. And we actually had two lead singers, Lee Freeman and Randy Seal. Randy Seal at the time was really just in the band as a drummer to replace Gene Gunnels, who quit because his girlfriend made him quit the band.
she's stupid.
He played drums on Incense and Peppermints, and then but the band hadn't done anything yet, and then so he quit, and then they got and Randy was coming in to do harmonies anyway, and so they asked Randy to be the drummer and to try to sing the song too, but
right.
His voice it was the wrong key for him too.
Right.
But anyway, that's basically the rundown of it. And then Craig Munford didn't want to be in the band because he was going to be like a solo career kind of guy, and he had his own band also.
And did he go on to success or no?
No, it was stupid. He thought that he was going to make it, and
nobody had
really made it yet.
Yeah, so you had a few John Best stories to tell there, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's exactly what it is.
Right. So I know. Go ahead, honey. I'm sorry.
I'm just going to say, he never really cared, and the band asked him to join the band.
Right.
You know, but he said no, and
right.
That's
wow.
the way it was.
Right. Now, John Carter and Tim Gilbert received full credit for the song, for the lyrics, and you guys did not, right? Did you ever settle that situation, or we can't discuss it?
Oh, no, you could discuss it, but it never got settled. Mark Stephen White, he likes to have his middle name in there because there's too many Mark Whites in the, in the world. But anyway, Mark Stephen White and Ed King... Edward Calhoun King. Ed and Mark wrote the music. Mostly it was Mark. And Ed wrote the bridge. And it was an instrumental. And then there was the, you know, when they did the lyrics, the producer said, okay, who wrote the music and who's going to be on the credit with John Carter and Tim Gilbert? And actually, Tim Gilbert, I don't think, wrote any part of it. They were just songwriting partners.
Yeah, partners, right. Yeah.
And so he said, well, it's going to be Mark and Ed, and the manager wanted his name on it because he paid for the recording session.
Right.
And the producer said, no, that's not going to happen. The producer was also the publisher.
Right,
and so he said, no, you're not going to do it that way. And then the manager said, well, I want everybody's name on it and mine. And then he said, no. And they went back and forth to the point where the producer just said, that's it. He sent it in. He sent the copyright in, and he didn't put anybody but John Carter and Tim Gilbert.
Yeah.
And then the line was, well, you can't really copyright the chord changes. You can only copyright the melody and the lyrics.
Correct, yeah.
But, you know, that applies to a Chuck Berry song maybe, but it doesn't apply to a song where the music is so, you know, involved as Incense and Peppermints.
Right.
And, you know, it's not a three-chord song.
No, it's not. It's a very intricate song. It very is. It really
yeah.
is. I wanted to ask you before. Well, let me just say, folks, if you want to give George a call, you can get him at 646-478-0999. Unfortunately, we only have until 7:30 tonight. So if you want to speak to him, please give us a call. And also, Marty Walsh wanted me to tell you hello.
Hi, Marty.
he's going to be joining us on, hold on, Marty, on the 22nd. Marty Walsh from Supertramp will be with us on the 22nd. So, also, now I had another question for you. Your album, Good Morning Starshine, was that before Oliver's hit or after?
Same time. Almost
really?
Simultaneously, yeah.
And what was the correlation between the two? None or just?
None. No, it just.
It just so happened to be.
Yeah, the alarm clock. I had quit the band before that album. But the alarm clock actually, their thinking was, like, who was it? The Cowsills, I guess.
They love the Cowsills. Yeah.
They did Hair, right?
Yes.
And it was from the same musical.
Right.
Well, and so. That was the idea at the time.
Right.
Here's another. This song could be good too. You know, Aquarius was a hit. You know, so they thought Good Morning Starshine would be a hit too. And so the alarm clock devoted their album. They called the album Good Morning Starshine, and you know, their whole push was for that. You know, the single and everything else.
Right.
And then But the record company, Uni Records, at that point, that was like their fourth album, final kind of thing. And they were done putting money into it as far as promotion and stuff.
Right.
So they did a minimal amount of promotion. And then Oliver's thing comes out and they jump all over it. Because I guess they knew that the Alarm Clock was coming out at the same time with an album called that.
Right,
and they just jumped all over the promotion for it and got his version out there more. The Alarm Clock version charted, but it, you know, the single did, but it died. You know, it was like it just got overwhelmed.
Was it the same song?
No. Yeah.
No kidding. Oh, wow. I didn't know that. I'll have to check that out.
Oh, yeah. It's the same. As a matter of fact.
So you guys wrote it then?
No, it was written for that play for,
Oh, okay. You took it from there. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Cool. And so your version must be like off the hook on that. I mean,
it's
totally
pretty good. I thought.
I know. I'm sure it is. I can't imagine it. I gotta go to YouTube and check that out. Oh man.
Yeah.
I definitely have to. I didn't know that. I thought you just had the same name. I didn't know it was the same song.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
It's a whole different version.
I'm sure it is.
They didn't hear each other's version, so
right.
It's kind of cool in that way. But
yeah,
as a matter of fact, the Alarm Clock used a theremin, which is, and it was actually the one from Mike Love's, you know, from Good Vibrations.
Yeah, yeah.
They
cool.
They used that same instrument and put it in that song. So their little thing goes.
Yeah,
It's that sound. It's that actual instrument.
Wow, cool.
Pretty cool.
Now,
yeah.
Let me ask you what happened. Like, you guys were, you had Skynyrd opening for you. Next thing you know, you've got Ed King joining Skynyrd. Well, how'd that go down? Were you guys like pissed about that? Or was like, what happened?
No, what that was that all that happened after I quit the band.
Oh, okay.
I did the first three albums. And then there was, well, it doesn't matter, but there was the drummer and I quit. And then the drummer Gene that had quit earlier.
Right.
He came back as the drummer. He's the drummer on the Good Morning Starshine album.
Wow.
But yeah. But,
wow.
Yeah, but there was the manager was crooked, and so the band had all agreed to fire this manager. And then in the meeting to fire him, he said he had cancer and 6 months to live. Well, that turned out to be not true anyway. And so the drummer and I both said, okay, we quit. And the rest of the guys went, oh, no, you know. So and that was just before the fourth album. Anyway, so – okay, wait, what was the last question?
About Ed joining
Ed. So that happened after I left. But Ed, I know the story because I've talked to Ed and talked to everybody about it. But they had another tour to do, and that tour was because there was some other band, partially my band that I was in, did a couple of dates as Strawberry Alarm Clock with the same manager, the crooked guy. And it was all mixed up. And there was, and then Greg Munford was out doing a Strawberry Alarm Clock with the same manager. And so they sent out cease and desist, and there was somebody else too. So they sent out cease and desist orders. There was, you know, Corey Feldman, his dad was the bass player.
No way.
He was Bob Feldman, but he was in a fake Strawberry Alarm Clock where they had nobody that had anything to do with the band.
Right, no original members, right.
Right, and they were out there trying to do it. So they're the ones that were served with the main, you know, cease and desist thing.
Right, of course.
Anyway, so the tour was sitting there, and then they said, well, do you guys want to do the tour? And so the leftover Alarm Clock guys, Ed King and Lee Freeman, and at the time it was Paul Marshall and Gene Gunnels, and they had just done Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, the movie soundtrack.
Yeah.
And so they said, okay, yeah, we'll go out. And Lynyrd Skynyrd was the opening act. And then they did a follow-up tour to it. They did two tours. And during that whole time, Ed King and Lee Freeman got along really well with Ronnie Van Zant.
Yeah.
And they had the same, you know, musical tastes And so they started jamming every day after the gigs. You know, they would, and they really enjoyed each other. And then after the second tour, Ronnie Van Zant told Ed, he said, and Lee, and they said, he said, if the alarm clock breaks up, he goes, call us. And they were like in Jacksonville, Florida. And so, and when Ed and Lee, that tour ended, they came back to California. And then the earthquake happened, and the band, the alarm clock broke up. And then the 1971 Sylmar earthquake happened here. And that Ed says, that's it. I'm moving. I'm leaving California, and I'm never coming back. And he never did.
Wow.
And he got in touch somehow with Ronnie Van Zant. I mean, you know, there's no cell phones. So,
yeah.
But I don't know exactly. There was another guy that was a mutual friend and said, hey, Ed, you know, because Ed went back to, like, somewhere. I forget what state he went back to, like North Carolina or something.
Right.
He might have gone back there with Gene because that's where he's from. And anyway, they managed to hook back up with Ronnie, and then Ronnie said, oh, great, our bass player just quit, which was another weird kind of, you know, full circle. But their bass player, Leon Wilkerson, his girlfriend or wife made him quit the band because they were doing nothing to go work for her dad's ice cream company. So that's how the opening came for a bass player. They said, okay, Ed, you want to play bass? And he was, you know, a guitar player, but he was also a bass player. And so he said, yeah. So he went back there. And Lee, our lead singer, also went back there. But Lee ended up being like their roadie kind of a guy. And his wife was making their clothes, and her name's Jan Salerno, and she did their album cover, the second Helping album cover. She drew that cover, and she used to make their clothes.
Wow.
And so Ed was the bass player, and they did that first album, whatever it's called, Lynyrd Skynyrd, I think.
Yeah.
And then the bass player wanted to come back because they had such success with that album. And, you know, with Freebird and everything became a, you know, huge hit.
Yeah.
And so he came back. And so they said, Ed, you're going to have to – you're no longer the bass player. So he thought he was out of a gig, but he wasn't. They wanted him to be a third guitar player. So that's how it ended up.
Cool.
And then he co-wrote Sweet Home Alabama.
Oh, wow. Cool. I didn't know he co-wrote it. That's cool.
Oh,
wow.
Yeah.
So you originally started as a piano player, and then you moved next to the Bartek guys, and the history was made. What made them say, or did you say, I'll take up the bass? Did anybody say, why don't you play bass instead? Or
I wasn't really a piano player. I just
you liked the accordion.
It was the accordion. I played accordion, and I played violin early on.
Yeah.
And then I got tired of those were in the school band, school orchestra, and it was too much trouble to carry the accordion, and it was also too much trouble to try to play the violin.
Yeah.
Anyway, and I couldn't, my idea of violin, I wanted to play fiddle, but that's not what I was getting to do.
Exactly.
I wanted to play bass. The first thing I had was just an acoustic guitar, or one of the kids in my neighborhood had an acoustic guitar in the neighborhood I lived in before I met the Bartek.
Wow.
And I used to play the bass part. Everybody wanted to be in a surf band. And so I used to sit around playing bass parts, and another kid had a guitar. And then when I moved next to the Bartek, then I got a bass that's all I ever did was play bass.
Wow. Well, now you said you used to play all the surf stuff. What could only imagine what kind of thrill that was for you when you played with the Beach Boys. I mean, that must have been phenomenal.
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, there's a quick little story. When I first, the first day that we were on the Beach Boy tour, it was with the Beach Boys and the Buffalo Springfield.
We were
goofy kids. I was 18 years old. The Beach Boys were one of my favorite things, but they had come out in 1961. So this first tour that we did with the Beach Boys was in 67. So they were already had been around for 6 years. That's like an eternity
when
you're 18.
Yeah, exactly.
And so the first, so they see it. We walk into this big auditorium for sound check, and it's empty except for Buffalo Springfield sitting in the middle and the Beach Boys on stage ready to do their thing.
Yeah.
And they welcome us in, and they go, oh, come on down. Come and sit down next to Buffalo Springfield. So I'm the first guy that walks in the aisle because they were sitting right in the middle, and I sit next to Neil Young.
Cool.
And he's like, by that time, that's who my idol was now. You know,
right,
like,
right.
And so I was like a nervous idiot kid, and I go, all right, surf music. And he looks over at me, and he goes, prepare to have your mind blown. I immediately shut my mouth. And I thought, okay, don't talk anymore. You're done. and then they counted off God Only Knows.
Wow, I love that song.
They had the backup band, and they had the whole thing.
Yeah.
And I sat there. I was so blown away by how good they were.
My hair would have stood up in my arms and gave me chills.
Yeah, that's what it was.
Exactly.
My hair was standing. And I, from there on, I never said another word, I don't think. I was like...
Excuse me. So did Neil Young or the Beach Boys ever give you any good advice, bad advice, or?
Oh, they did all the time. Yeah, constantly.
Because you were kids.
We were kids. Neil Young kept saying, "You've got to buy land. Don't blow this money. You got to buy land." And then we met up when we got back to L.A. too, and. Because then we did another tour, so we met up in between tours too, and had lunch and stuff. But it was pretty remarkable. And then the Beach Boys would at soundcheck, they would stand on stage with us and get us move our mouths to the microphone and tell us where to be, and get the sounds on our amplifiers and make sure everything sounded right, because we all used the same amplifiers and stuff. And then they had this. Steven Desper was a genius sound man, so it was actually the best we ever sounded.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's great. Imagine that.
And then they asked us to do a second tour, which was...
Fantastic.
Great. Yeah.
Right? That's fantastic. My God. I can't imagine that. Oh, my God. Could you imagine that, John? Oh, my God.
I couldn't.
With the Beach Boys and Neil Young. Unbelievable.
That must have been fantastic. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Right. Now, I wanted to ask, I know the story behind where you got the name Strawberry Alarm Clock. You want to share it with our folks?
Well, it's pretty easy, too.
Yes, it is.
The band used to rehearse in Mark Weitz's parents' guest house. And the guest house had where the band, you know, like a little living room, which was where we were all set up. The only place to sit around and talk was in Mark's little bedroom. And so what ended up happening was they told the band, okay, you got to get rid of, the band was called The Sixpence. And there was like some other band in England that was called The Sixpence. And you have to get rid of this name. It's terrible. And there's a bunch of other bands with a similar name.
Right.
And so Mark wanted to have Strawberry in the name because of Strawberry Fields Forever. He thought it was psychedelic, and he thought that would be cool. And there were all these stories about us taking out Billboard and putting our finger down, and there it was, Strawberry Fields Forever. But that isn't really what happened.
Right.
And so Mark just liked it, Strawberries, because of the song. And then,
now, were the Raspberries already out by then, or they came later?
No, they weren't out yet.
Okay. No, I was wondering if there was a little...
I think the Chocolate Watch Band was out, but that's not where we got it. I don't think we were aware of the Chocolate Watch Band yet.
Yeah.
And so because mainly because we're isolated here in the San Fernando Valley.
Yeah.
And we were little kids. But if something wasn't like coming from England or world famous like the Birds or something, then we didn't really know who it was.
Right.
And but anyway, so Mark had this little Big Ben alarm clock in his room, and so we were trying to think of things. I wasn't even there, but the band was trying to think of things to go with Strawberry. Right. And Mark's little Big Ben alarm clock started making a noise when it was going around, but nobody noticed it till it got real quiet.
Yeah.
And Lee and Mark looked at each other and said, huh, alarm clock, strawberry alarm clock. So that was it.
Definitely different. Definitely different.
They called the record company and told them, and the record company goes, wow, that's genius.
Yeah, exactly, right.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, you know, when you hear Incense and Peppermints, I mean, you, like you said, were into surf and all that, but you can hear the influences of the different sounds, because back then Top 40 was a mix of everything, pop, rock, you know, soul, blues, and your influences, you can hear it because it's got a little bit of a Beatles sound, a little bit of the Birds, it's got a little bit of the Kinks, the Beach Boys with the keys, and, you know, it's got a little bit of everything, which is great, but it's so distinct that it doesn't sound like that. You know what I mean? But you could hear the influence of what you guys were into.
Yeah, you can hear all different sorts of things.
Oh, there's a lot of things going on in there.
One of them is the Animals. You know, bam,
I could hear that. Yep, I could hear that. Yep.
That lick is actually very much the Animals.
Right. Well, in the bridge, I when I hear the bridge, I hear something like, oh, I hear somebody else, but not, I feel like somebody took it from you, like another song that was taken from your song, you know what I mean? Like, you know, but it is a great song, it really is, Incense and Peppermints, and I definitely got to check out your version of Good Morning Starshine. That's probably, like, fantastic. I can't even think to even guess what it sounds like. So what are you guys up to now? Are you still together? Do you do any of these happy together tours or anything like that?
No, we don't like to do those things. But we do shows and we do some stuff. We did some stuff with Billy Corgan of Smashing Pumpkins.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like we were in the studio with him. As a matter of fact, we're still putzing around with the stuff that we recorded. And I guess we're going to release it. And we've got, I don't know, six songs or something. We even really just redid Incense and Peppermints with Ed King and with Greg Munford, with all of us.
Right.
So we just did that, like, just before Ed passed away.
Right. Yeah.
And so we're going to put that on there, too.
So let me ask you this real quick. When the song was in Austin Powers, did that kind of say to you, God, we got to get back out there. Let's do it.
And sort of. Because a lot of calls came in.
Right.
We had already been playing, you know, doing shows, like quite a few, actually, from like 1982 or so on, from like 82 until Austin Powers happened.
Right.
And then we decided to get, most of that time, Mark Weitz didn't want to do it.
Right.
And because he had his own business and he didn't want to be involved with the band, and he had a bad taste because there was a bunch of lawsuits and stuff.
Right.
But Danny decided, well, you know, maybe it's time I'll do the band. So like in 2006, we started to do it. At the end of 2006, we were going to do that T.J. Lubinsky show that he does. It's a PBS thing with this with all the 60s bands.
Oh, cool.
I think Happening 60s or whatever it was. And we were slated to do it, and then the contracts that they sent weren't amenable to us, and so we passed on it. And he goes,
right.
You're passing? And we were like, yeah, we're passing.
Oh,
that's kind
of
how the band is. We're kind of like, we will pass on things. You don't
right.
anything. But
you're not just doing it for the money. You're doing it for
right.
the love of it. Right.
So right now we have five of original members, five guys that played on the first album.
That's cool, because that's hard to find.
Members. And we've even had like a couple of guys pass away, you know, Ed and both passed away. And then recently Jimmy Pittman passed away.
Oh, I didn't know Jimmy just passed away. I know that Ed King passed away in August, right?
And Jimmy Pittman just passed away.
Wow.
And,
sorry.
Yeah. And he's the one that sang Good Morning Starshine.
Wow.
And anyway.
As soon as we get off the show, I'm listening to that.
Jimmy Pittman hadn't been doing any of our more recent stuff, but the guy that got us back together in 2007, the catalyst guy, was actually Roger Ebert, the film critic.
No kidding. Oh.
Yeah. He wrote the screenplay for Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, which the band was in, and he wrote the band into the screenplay. Then he was doing, he used to do this Overlooked Film Festival every year. And so in 2007, it was his 9th Overlooked Film Festival, and he wanted us to close the show.
Cool.
And so after the movie aired, the screen went up and the curtains opened up, and there was all of us. So there were 9 of us on stage.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And and so we, everybody but Jimmy Pittman, which was kind of an oversight, but I wasn't in touch with him at the time.
Right.
But anyway, so we got together and we did that. Uh-huh. We stayed together. We kept playing.
Excellent. Well, now listen, George, we have listeners across the whole country, even worldwide. Where can they see you guys play out right about now or coming up?
Our next show is November 21st in Westlake Village, California, at a club called Bogey's. And we play there a couple of times a year. And we play at the Whiskey A Go-Go in Hollywood about twice a year.
Cool.
We just played there in July.
Oh, cool. And where can everybody go and see where you have upcoming shows?
StrawberryAlarmClock.com.
Easy enough.
We have it's a neat website, so it's pretty much up to date and everything's cool there.
Right.
So it's operating.
Right. Good. Well, George, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on. I appreciate it. And John, we love having you on. And I owe you more time. Please.
Okay.
You know, if you don't mind, I'd love to have you back on because we could talk for hours about there were so many things we didn't touch on. So we'd love to have you on again. And thank you again for, accommodating us tonight. We appreciate that by all means. And it's been a pleasure. And ladies and gentlemen, on Applause Radio Show, Mr. George Bunnell from Strawberry Alarm Clock, Incense and Peppermints, and go check out their version of Good Morning Starshine on YouTube, because I know I'm doing that at 8 o'clock. And thank you, George. Take
care,
hon. Thank you so much. Have a good night.
You too. Thank
you. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right,
hey,
Mr. Lucchio. How are you? Yes.
We have good. We have Cynthia Lowen on the phone now, and she's going to talk to us about her movies, Bully, and her new movie, Netizens. I'm curious about that last one. I've seen the clips from the Bullying movie, and it's fantastic. So I'll turn it over to you, Joanne, and welcome,
hey,
Cynthia.
Yes.
Hi.
Cynthia.
Thank you.
Hi. Welcome to the show. Thank you so much
for
joining us. We appreciate it. So tell us about your new movie. Oh no, thank you. Tell us about the new movie, Netizens.
Yeah, so, I think this film really grew out of Bully, which, of course, you mentioned, and that was a film that came out in 2012 when we followed 5 kids and families through a year of bullying. It was released, and it was released by the Weinstein Company, which is sort of an interesting
I want to touch on that. I definitely want to touch on that.
Bullies.
And
so, after that book came out, I was hearing a lot.
It did very, very well.
It did. We screened in movie theaters all around the world. We came out on, all the online platforms and Netflix and, all that.
Right.
We were on TV.
And it needed to be done. That's for sure.
Yeah. The interesting thing about that film is when we started it, everyone was like, we were like, bullying, it's really bad. And people were like, oh yeah, well, that's just like kids being kids. It's like, that's just, life. And we were kind of like, well,
no,
there were all these suicides of young people happening around 2009. And we were like, this is not normal when you have young people killing themselves over this.
Right.
So we made that film with the hope that we could, you know, challenge this idea that bullying was just a normal thing that we had to accept in our schools and communities. And this film really grew out of a similar thing, which was, you know, for most of us, when we go online, you see, you know, you see threats, you see all kinds of stuff. You see, you know, you hear about celebrities having their nude pictures spread all over the place. You hear, you know, about threats so bad people have to leave their house. And the attitude for a long time was like, oh, yeah, well, that's just the Internet. The Internet is the Wild West. And
well, was there,
you know,
was there anybody in particular that made you want to write this new movie about the
So she's in the film, Anita Sarkeesian. So Anita,
is she a friend of yours, or is she a friend, or just you heard about her?
I heard about her through a very high-profile series of attacks on women in the gaming industry, and it came to be known as Gamergate. And this was in 2014. A lot of women in the gaming industry were attacked by these coordinated online mobs. And the threats were so violent that a lot of them, including Anita, had to leave their homes. But law enforcement and the tech companies were not really doing anything about it. And so I had heard about that and was like, this is really crazy. This is, like, not right. You can't, like, threaten to murder someone and – you know, have that not be against the law.
And get away with it, right.
Yeah, but they were, and they have.
Exactly.
I mean, there have
been
no sanctions against anyone who's issued, you know, thousands of death threats against her. So I was
unbelievable.
Like, what's going on here? So that was the story that really made me want to start this film. And then it took a very different, you know, it follows all kinds of situations.
So in this movie, I believe you're doing three people's lives that you're working on, or is it more or two?
Yeah, so there's three women that I follow really closely for about 2.5 years, and I'm just like, you know, I was basically like there when they woke up in the morning. So one is Anita Sarkeesian. Another is an internet privacy attorney named Kerry Goldberg, who has her law firm has just totally exploded, and she's actually been representing some of the women in cases against Harvey Weinstein. But she herself went through a situation where someone was threatening her, threatening to expose nude pictures and all this stuff online, and she was a lawyer at the time doing elder law, and she couldn't find anyone to represent her. So she totally shifted gears and started this law firm for internet privacy and sexual harassment. And again, she's just become a superstar. And then Tina Riney is a successful businesswoman. She went to Columbia Business School and was working on Wall Street and had her career totally derailed by an ex-boyfriend who created numerous websites saying, you know, she was escorting and taking business trips to go on dates and you know, all this stuff really intended to destroy her career.
Yeah, and people don't realize what you say about somebody online will affect, and what you say online, you know, will affect your future.
Yeah.
I mean, they, especially these kids today, they don't realize what they're doing down the line. You know, you go for a job interview, people are going to look that up and say, what? You know? So,
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And it's just crazy. Well, excuse me, I think I have strep throat. So I think what's going to happen here with this movie is you're going to have the same instance with bully, because once people see this, they're going to say, oh my God, that's me. This happened to me too. And you're going to have another, you know, you're going to have a lot of people coming out to tell you about their story. So this is going to blow up. For sure.
Yeah. That's our hope. I mean, it's been amazing. Every time, you know, I talk to people about this film, you know, it's like, so many people have gone through this or know someone, you know, so many people said, oh, I have a friend or I have a sister. She tried to break up with a guy and then he threatened to spread all these pictures around. Or, you know, I have a restaurant, I have a business, and there's this vindictive, crazy person who's putting up all this stuff on all of our review pages and I can't get it off and it's really harming my business. So, you know, it's not just women, and
I was gonna say,
it's not just individuals.
I was going to say, did you find that it's more women or men this is being done to?
in your experience?
It is more in the kind of harassment that I was looking at, which is like really gendered, things like revenge porn. It is definitely more women. And things like, you know, stalking, digital stalking. It's such a part of domestic violence. So, that I found was the threats that are very, you know, sexually explicit or graphically violent tend to be toward women. But men also are really vulnerable to having their reputations destroyed, their businesses destroyed. And so I've found that even though this film focuses on women, I feel like men have really responded to the film and they really get it.
Yeah, right. Well, I want to
Cynthia, I got a question for Cynthia. By doing the film, what did you find out how we can protect ourselves from these people who are out to destroy us? What do we do? Well, what can we do?
Right.
You know, there's a few things you can do, but one thing that's really important, and it's not just vanity, is to Google yourself. It's really important to know what comes
what
up when you Google
saying,
yourself.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there's folks who are like, I keep not getting, you know, I only get so far in these job interviews and I think I'm doing great. And then things go silent. And what they realize is, oh, my God, someone has, like, created a bunch of crazy stuff out there about them and it's coming up.
And how do you remove
them.
That? How do you remove it from Google? I mean, how do you do that?
Exactly. So that's a huge problem. So Google will now remove revenge porn from its indexing. But, you know, in the case of Tina, where, you know, it wasn't revenge porn, but it was really damaging information and websites, she actually had to go through a process, you know, to go to the perpetrator and say, will you, through a lawyer, of course, and say, you know, will you give me the copyright to the content of these websites you've created
Are
about
you
me?
Kidding me?
So
they own a copyright to it. Oh, wow.
Yes. So the laws that are being used to confront this are copyright laws, which is ridiculous.
Right. Well, yeah, this has to change because with the way that we are moving with technology, laws need to be put in place to protect people because this, you know, we're living on laws that were created hundreds of years ago and things have changed dramatically. So, there's things that need to be changed a lot that need to be in some type of correlation with what we're doing today in regards to the internet and the use of it. And, you know, anybody could say what they want. It's crazy. I mean, I've had it happen to me, but not in a degree where it's been, where it's put me in a position where I haven't been able to get a job, thank God. But, I mean, people are sick. They are sick.
Yeah.
I mean, especially with this radio show, since we've had the radio show, I'm getting friends coming out of the woodwork, which is fine, great. I'd love to have you as a fan, a friend. But the first thing they say to me, especially the guys, is, are you single? This, that. I mean, right away, just because I accepted you doesn't mean I want you as a, you know, sexually. I accepted you because you're a fan or a friend. And, you know, there's a difference. And right away, you got these people on the internet that's all they're looking for, you know. It's crazy.
Right.
And there's got to be things put in place to stop it.
Yeah, you know, my hope with this film is that there's a few there's things that we can do as private citizens, like Google yourself, at least then you know, or use these, you know, two-step verifications for your passwords. Any site that says, would you like us to send you a text message every time we get a login from a new computer, do that.
That's a great
idea. Those are really effective things. And making sure that your privacy settings are set up in a way that, you know, one thing I do is I make sure people can't see who my friends are on my social media platforms because what
how
people
do
is
that?
They.
I've been trying to do that. How do you do that?
So if you Google search how to make friend lists blocked on Facebook.
Gotcha. Okay.
Look it up. But that's something that's important because usually what people will do is they'll go for your friend group to try to spread really negative information about you or a lot of people who have revenge porn, it always goes first to, you know, their friends, their family, their employer, and their dad. And also, look for your address.
I'm sorry.
Make sure you're, get yourself off these stupid people finder databases. They're really dangerous. No one needs to know where we live.
It's true. That's true. I wouldn't put my address either. I mean, you know, but I mean, my kids are like totally computer. They're on it all the time, playing with people from around the world. As far as I know, I mean, so far we haven't had any issues, thank God. But you know, when they were little, I said, "Don't ever tell people where you live or whatever. Don't tell them that stuff."
Yeah,
and, you
but
know,
you'd
thank
be
God they
shocked.
Never have, but.
So you'd be shocked to know how many, like, if you've never gone through and intentionally removed yourself from, you know, whitepages.com, peoplefinder.com, you know, instantcheckmate.com, you're going to be on all of them. So it's worth just, like, you know, getting a glass of wine, sitting down for an hour, and you're like, okay, I'm just going to go through all these and submit my remove me request.
Right, but don't you think the from the get-go, they shouldn't have created these sites like,
absolutely.
Oh, you can find out everything about this person, their criminal background, their where they live, their phone number, I mean, their age.
Absolutely.
I mean, they should have never let these people create these. Those should be taken down first. That should
be
done. They should put them out of business. And
another thing,
I mean, no ill will towards anybody, especially in the movie. Don't do naked pictures.
Well, I think
that would avoid it entirely.
Yeah, but I think there's the thing that's really important to understand about that is that oftentimes those pictures are created under. There's a lot of times where women don't even know that the videos
that's
or pictures
true.
Exist. Because the men are filming them and photographing them without their knowledge. Or, you know, lots of women are in a situation where they're under so much pressure to spread those, to give those pictures. It's like, don't you trust me? Don't you love me? Don't you want to be in this relationship? And I think the thing for women to know is that's a red flag.
Well, John and I have been married a long time. I don't know about you, John. I don't know anything about dating somebody that would say, let me take a picture of you naked or you don't love me. It's like saying back in the day when have sex with me or you don't love me. I mean, is that the new trend?
You know, I think sharing pictures has become part of intimacy. And I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing if two people trust each other. They may be long distance. It may just be part of their relationship. But I think that it's not to shame the person who, for whatever reason,
if somebody says, if you don't do this, you don't love me, that's ridiculous. I mean,
Like
I said, if John and I in our relationships now, if we said, oh, let me take a picture of you naked, I mean, of course, we've been married so long. What's the big deal?
Right.
You know?
Right. But I think often it's that tough situation where you don't want to lose someone's love. It can be very hard to say, you know, I don't feel comfortable with that. If you're afraid, even in I think it's good to know that's a sign of a really unhealthy relationship.
They don't love you if they don't accept the fact that you say I'm uncomfortable with that. They don't love you then.
Right. Right. I agree.
You know,
but I have empathy for the fact that these situations are often complicated and the pictures often get shared in with trust that shouldn't have been given to somebody. But I think shame the person who violated someone's trust. Don't shame the person who wanted to believe that they could trust that individual.
Right. Exactly. Well, without giving away the ending of the movie, how do these ladies fare at the end? Are is there a way you could go around that without giving out the end of the movie?
Oh, yeah. You know, the fight continues, honestly. You know, we're having this conversation right now in the midst of, like, it's all still happening. You know, we've realized that. There's, you know, these mobs that first were going after women. We now have, you know, an explosion of all kinds of violent mobs. There's so many people
right.
who, you know, they all these mass shootings, what do? They look
oh.
back and say, well, what were they doing on social media? You know, they were violent. A lot of them were threatening women. The,
yeah,
like,
right.
the violence that starts online moves offline. But I think what's
right.
happening is that we're now realizing it's real. You know,
yeah.
online harassment,
yeah.
online threats, online violence, it's not a
right.
figment of our imagination. It's a
oh,
sign
no, no, no.
of something.
Yeah.
So, you know, in the meantime, Anita's doing great. She has continued to create great projects and great films in the face of, you know, every time she does something, she gets a wave of harassment, but she does it. She continues. Tina is continuing her fight.
That's good. That's good.
And Carrie just published a book called Nobody's Victim. And
oh,
her
wow.
law firm is like, you know, just gangbusters. It's awesome.
Right. She's going to be getting a lot more business now once this comes out. And you have a premiere. You have a premiere coming, what, next week, I believe
yes.
it is? You want to tell everybody
yes.
about it?
I would love to tell everybody about it. So we
cool,
are
cool.
going to be launching our national community screening tour. So we are bringing the film for one night only to New York, Chicago, San Francisco, Washington, D.C., and Miami. And these are really special screenings because we're going to have panels and Q&As. I will be
nice.
At several of the screenings, and the film's subjects will be at some of the screenings. And what we're going to do is have a conversation about the issue with, like, the most important voices on
right.
the issue of harassment and
right.
abuse participating.
Right.
And we want audiences to really be part of this and share with us and to, you know, be part of solving this problem.
Well, we are heard across the country, so can just anybody go to these events? Is there a way
yeah.
to get tickets?
So,
and
you can find tickets on our website, and it is netizensfilm.com, and that
cool.
is netizensfilm.com.
Right.
And we're really excited to be getting it out there and having people really use this as a tool for change, especially for,
cool.
you know, if you know people in law enforcement, if you know folks in tech, if you know policymakers, you know, get them out there because we want
right.
this to really be seen by people who are on the front lines of figuring out what are we going to do about this.
Right, exactly, exactly. And now back to Bully, if you don't mind. Oh, wait, first before I go on to Bully. Now, once you do these special screenings, will it be available in theaters or Netflix? Where can
it
people see
be,
that after that?
Yes, so starting on October 22nd, it will be available on iTunes, Apple iTunes, Google Play,
cool.
Amazon, and Xbox.
Excellent. And John, is there a way for us to play the trailer, make the trailer available on our site?
Yeah, I think we could link it to the IMDb page or a trailer that we could find. You know, yeah, sure, we could do that.
But
I
we have the trailer.
We
have the trailer. I just didn't get a chance to send it to John today. Unfortunately, I'm sick. So, but I do
yeah.
have it, and I wanted to see if John could put it up. So I was hoping that we could. So that's great. So I'll have to send
Thank
it to
you.
John if you could do that.
Well,
excellent.
Well, Cynthia, I got a question for Cynthia. I'm a filmmaker too, and a lot of people don't realize all the time and effort that we put into making these things. And I'd like to know how you got into making films, and also to tell the people a little bit about all the process of making something like this. It's not
yeah.
an easy task.
Oh my goodness! Yeah, it's a journey. Every film is like a whole world. You know,
well,
I have
well, you
a very,
said you followed these women for 2 years and then you did the movie. So how long
yeah.
was the actual process? How long was the actual process to get the finished product?
So it's been about from the time I started, it's been about 3.5-4 years
wow.
at this point. It's getting there.
Wow.
You know, so I had a very unusual route to filmmaking. I actually got my MFA in poetry
oh, wow.
and I worked at a poetry publishing press. I wrote a poetry book that won the National Poetry Series about J.
Very
Robert
good.
Oppenheimer and the making of the atomic bomb. You know, I really, honestly, I saw a film at the Tribeca Film Festival, a documentary called Favela Rising, and the subjects of the film were there, and I just couldn't believe it. It was so magical to see the people from the film on stage after this film had played, and just to realize that, you know, people's real lives were like the raw material for these incredibly moving films.
Right.
And I just was
right.
like, that's what I want to do. I want to do that. And
wow.
so I, you know, started with an internship on a film, you know, like an unpaid production assistant kind of internship, and started meeting people in the industry and making relationships with other directors and producers and getting hired to work on other films. And then
a lot of work.
Yeah.
A lot of work.
But it's a process. You know, from fundraising to, honestly, in this at this time with independent film, I think the biggest challenge is just fundraising to get the movie
right. money,
made.
Money, 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 yeah.
Yep.
Now, Bully, do you think Bully, how can I say this? With Harvey Weinstein's escapades and everything that came out, do you think it affected Bully's doing well? I mean, because it was already doing well, you know.
Yeah, I mean, when I feel like we really, that film really came out and had its big national premiere and world premiere and everything prior to the, you know, revelations about him. But I
right.
also
well, the Bully
say,
also Bully also raised his career too.
Right, ironically, I mean
yeah,
very
exactly.
painful. It's very painful
yeah.
as a filmmaker to know that, especially a filmmaker
right.
whose work is committed to social justice and making the world a better
right.
place. It's actually a terrible feeling.
Exactly.
But you know, we were independent. We produced that film independently. We made that film independently. They did not pick that film up until after we premiered at Tribeca. And so
right.
we did our distribution with them, but that film was such an independent, spirited film. And we
gotcha.
Created all of that impact work that we did with the film, with the educational materials, with the partnerships, with getting
right.
it out into the world in the way we did, was all done by the filmmaking team independently.
Excellent.
That was really kind of
so it was already done.
Had.
All they did was it was distributed by Weinstein Entertainment. That's it.
Yeah, I mean, and they put a lot of, you know, power, as they do, behind marketing and publicity and stuff
right.
like that. So they
right.
certainly bring a lot to the table with marketing and publicity. But in terms of the vision for that film to have a real impact in the world in the way it did, that was all from Lee, my partner on that film, and I.
Right. Now, Bully, you said, was brought to your attention because, you know, the kids were committing suicide and whatnot. You weren't bullied yourself. It was just you felt that something needed to be done, right?
I mean, as a child, I was definitely extremely shy, and I think I was that kid that was just desperately sailing under the radar so that I wouldn't bring
yeah.
the attention of the bullies on myself. So I would say I was a very intimidated, shy child who did not have the tools to stand up for the people I saw being bullied until
right.
I was an adult. So I really understood that position of being, I could imagine very easily that I could have been that person who was the target.
Right. Right. Wow. Well, I've been wanting to see Bully, and unfortunately I haven't yet, but I definitely am going to. And also, I want to check out the new movie, too. And what happened for me, too, as John's a movie guy, I'm a musician, and I actually had the same feeling as you. It's like, oh, my God, these kids, they're all committing suicide over being bullied, and... So I actually wrote a CD, music for kids that were being bullied. They were regular songs, but just saying that it's okay, you know, it's going to be okay. Hang in there, you know, that type of
yeah.
thing. And I called it Sticks and Stones. And I don't sell anything. I give it away. So
that's awesome.
Whoever I thought was being bullied, or like when somebody tells me their kids are being bullied, I send them a copy. And, you know, I've been told that they love it because the kids just really, really like it a lot, because they just are songs that say, you know, hang in there. It's okay, you know. But
that's great.
Yeah. So now, is this your start of your kickoff for your movie? Is this your first interview? Or no, you've done more already?
No, I've done some already. And we've been on, so we premiered at Tribeca, and then we've been screening in film festivals since last spring all over the world. So the film has been everywhere from New York to Toronto to Moscow.
Wow.
And St. Petersburg.
Right.
And Oslo and Bergen and Zurich.
Right.
And so we've been all over the world, and it's been incredible because so many people are like, they get it. And they're going
right.
through it.
So many people can relate to it. I just want to say good luck with it, because it's something that needs to be told, just like Bully was. And you know, you're going to get a flood of people coming out again, just like Bully, mm-hmm. saying, oh, my God, this happened to me. What do I do? You know, and it's fabulous. I appreciate what you do. That's for sure. And
I
would love to catch it. I would love to catch it. Maybe I'll go to the New York thing and premiere. And maybe I'll bump into you.
I'll be there.
Excellent. Well, John, do you have anything else for Cynthia? Or?
Well, I'm just thankful she called in tonight, because it was an
yes,
excellent show.
Yes, me too. Yes,
aww,
and we appreciate
thank
that.
You.
Thank you so much. Yes. Well, it was an absolute
thank you
pleasure.
To both of you.
No, thank
and,
you.
And maybe we can have Cynthia back after the premiere one day, and she can tell us how everything went and give her a full hour.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
There you go.
If you're into that, that'd be great.
I'd love to.
Excellent. All right. Well, Cynthia, we're going to definitely put the trailer up, because John is our fantastic technical guru over there, and he's going to take care of that for us. I'll send it to him tonight, and we could get that up there when he has a moment. And again, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much. We appreciate what you do.
Mm-hmm.
More people should be doing it and get the word out, especially for all different kinds of causes. I'm sure you do. You have anything in the works that's coming up that you could tell us about? Another type of movie?
Yeah, you know, I'm starting to kind of dive in a little bit to two different things. One is the role of doctors in the opioid epidemic, and the other is looking at, you know, what I think is another really silent epidemic of violence, which is elder abuse.
Oh, that's a good one. Because you know what? That is something that goes on every day, too. It's
yep.
horrible. What is happening to this kind? What is happening to this world? It's sick. I can't take it anymore. I can't take it anymore. I'm just done.
Well, we're coming to the end of our show.
I know. Real quick. Cynthia, every day I apologize to my kids. I say, I'm so sorry that you have to live in a world like this, because it was never like this when I was a child, because it's so sad. Cynthia, thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you,
everybody.
Thank you, John.
Cynthia Lowen.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Writer, movie director from new movie, Nittison, and also Bully. Check it out. It's coming out. You can check it out and go to her website, nittisons.com. And it was a pleasure. Thank you, Cynthia. And we'd love to have you back.
All right, netizensfilm.com. Thank you.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Thank you. Netizensfilm.com.
Okay.
I appreciate you
all
correcting
right.
me. Thank you. All right, you have a good
thank
night.
You.
Take
Cynthia.
Care. It was a pleasure. Thank you.
All right.
And good
care.
Night, everybody.
Bye. Yes, good
bye.
Night.
And we'll see you
John?
On Wednesday. Who's coming up on Wednesday,
yeah,
Joanne?
Say, John, do we have a moment to make some announcements real quick?
Yeah, we got about 30 seconds.
All right, Wednesday, the 18th, Tammy Locke. She's a childhood star. We'll put more information up on the site about her. She just got the cover story on Hollywood Reporter, and she is thrilled, and I'm thrilled for her. And then on the 22nd, we have Marty Walsh from Supertramp. And the 25th, we have Susan Jax. She sang, I can't sing tonight.
Which way you going, Billy?
And the 29th, we're up in the air on the 29th, because John may not be able to make it, but we have a I don't want to call her a psychic. She's an angel, and she is the Jersey Shore angel, and she is going to be reading for you your people you've lost. You could call her a psychic, I guess, in this regard, so I can describe it better. She'll be able to call in, and she'll be able to read you. So that should be exciting, but we may have to make a different date for that because we want John to join us for that. So, but everybody, thank you to George. Thank you to George Bunnell from the Strawberry Alarm Clock. We love you. Cynthia Lowen, thank you. We love you for what you do. Good luck to everybody. John, I love you too. Have a good night, and we'll talk soon, everybody.
Okay, good night, everybody.
Good night.